The Guardian.
Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
As a new thriller about ghostwriting and dodgy politicians hits the cinema, we look at whether the ghost is in fact master or mistress of the dark arts. We ask the master of the digested reed, John Crace, to digest the relationship between Wayne Rooney and his ghost, Hunter Davis. First, though, to introduce our ghostwriting theme, here's a clip from the film The Ghost, which goes out on general release this weekend. Ewan McGregor negotiates a contract to write the autobiography of a disgraced Prime Minister.
I'm not going to pretend to be someone I'm not. You have my CV.
His last effort was the autobiography of a magician. I came, I soared, I conquered.
Yeah, and it went straight to number one. So.
After you turned it down, Roy. Look, I don't read political memoirs. Who does? Adam Lang, he wants a place in history, not in the remainder tables.
Oh, please.
It's because I know nothing about politics that I'll ask the questions that get right to the heart of who Adam Lang is. And that is what sells autobiographies.
Some home truths there from Ewan McGregor in a scene from Roman Polanski's new film, The Ghost. Ghostwriting's one of those words that's not quite respectable in journalistic circles, though most of us know someone who's done it. Indeed, one of them is in the studio with us today. He's Guardian feature writer Simon Haddonstone. Also with us is Peter Bradshaw, who comes hot foot from a screening of The Ghost, which of course is from a novel of the same name by Robert Harris. So let's start with you, Peter. In one of those eccentricities of a film critic's life, you first reviewed The Ghost from the Berlin Film Festival back in February, where it won a Best Director gong for Polanski. You described it as a gripping conspiracy thriller and a scabrous political satire, a Manchurian candidate for the 2010s, no less. Tell us more about it.
Yes, it won, controversially in the eyes of some, though not me, it won an award at the Berlin Film Festival and opens this Saturday in the UK. I think it's a terrifically funny book by Robert Harris and has been translated into a terrifically effective, no-frills, very enjoyable thriller, probably the most enjoyable film that Polanski's made in some time.
It's about the Blairs, basically, is it?
Undoubtedly it is. I think there's a vast amount of highly futile and unrewarding debate we can have about whether or not it is about the Blairs. Clearly it's inspired by the Blairs.
So tell us the plot.
The plot is that a seedy and down-at-heel journo and professional ghostwriter who specialised in writing the ghostwritten autobiographies of yucky Z-list celebs has been chosen, tellingly, to write or rewrite the ghostwritten memoirs of a rather embattled ex-British Prime Minister, here called Adam Lang.
Who's in America because he's guilty of war crimes, basically.
Well, he's been accused of war crimes by the International Criminal Court of The Hague, and the United States is one of the few countries that does not recognise this court. So, in fact, Adam Lang, as he's fictionally called, has become marooned in the United States, which is, I think, a rather clever fictional rendering of the way in which Tony Blair has become marooned in the neocon celebrity circles of the United States right now. Mm. It has also, ironically, come to be seen as an unintended parallel with the way Roman Polanski is effectively under house arrest in his own kind of rich citadel in Switzerland.
So now the central character, apart from the Blairs, is the ghostwriter who's been hired to turn out a sanitised picture.
Yes, what's happened is that there is a strange and unanswered question about what happened to the first ghostwriter. He's been found dead, and the question appears to be that in his initial manuscript, which appears to be a straight transcription of the Prime Minister's own unreadably boring waffle, there is nevertheless something desperately dangerous and explosive hidden somewhere in this text, and that it provides the clue not merely to the first ghostwriter's sinister and unexplained death, but to something terrifying, a terrifying secret at the heart of the Prime Minister and, by implication, at the heart of the British and US establishment itself.
Now, Simon, seedy and down-at-heel journalist, is that something you identify with as somebody who has, on occasion, ghosted things?
Probably as a journalist I do, but not necessarily as a ghostwriter. I'm really proud of my ghostwriting. I did two books, and they were at a very similar time. They were in parallel, and they were very different. One was the autobiography of the snooker player Ronnie O'Sullivan, and the other was the autobiography of Dwayne Brooks, who was the then boy who was attacked with Stephen Lawrence on the night that Stephen Lawrence was murdered. and came in for an incredibly hard time from the establishment and suffered terrible post-traumatic stress. And I'm incredibly proud of that book. I'm incredibly proud of both books, actually, even though they're not my books.
Well, let's go back and actually break down a little bit what ghostwriting is, because as it's actually a huge area, isn't it, Peter? I mean, it's something that stretches way back into history.
Yes, it does. As I understand it, the term arose because of wanting to give famous sports stars in the early 20s, the baseball star Babe Ruth and the tennis star Bill Tilden, had to produce books and syndicated newspaper columns for their armies of fans. And that kind of triggered a new ancillary industry of writers, journalists, and sort of humble kind of team players who would turn out pros. And the term was invented. They were their ghosts. There wasn't what we would think of now as the professionalism of the ghost, somebody who used this term. They talk it out of them. They listen to their tone of voice and they replicate, like a kind of pub tribute band, they replicate that tone and churn it out to 60, 70, 80,000 words.
Mm. Simon, is that your experience of working with Ronnie O'Sullivan, since he fits into this tradition of sports ghosting, doesn't he?
Who, of course, is the great snooker player. I think it's different from how it was. In the old days, ghosts were genuine ghosts, they were invisible, weren't they? Whereas now we get a little credit and a little byline on it. I think what was very important in terms of Ronnie is someone who had an amazing story. He didn't have one story, he had loads of stories. He was like a snooker prodigy at 12. By 15, his dad was in prison for murder. By 16, his mum was in prison for tax evasion, and he was bringing up the family by himself. He had loads of depression. He was funny. He'd had a kind of hellish and heavenly life. And I think the skill in writing his book, for me, is telling his story in a way that sounds like him, but also sounds like a written book. So it's not exactly copying his voice, but it's getting part of his voice. Mm. But if you got it all, it wouldn't read like a book.
So it's really an extension of the big feature interview in a magazine, is it? It's like an extended feature interview.
I think that's why interviewers tend to be quite good at ghosting, because weirdly or not, for journalists, it's about submerging ego. And to me, the best, what I love in an interview is when you capture someone's voice. You know, it's not what you say so much, it's when you can hear the person talking. And to do that, you kind of have to slightly forget about what you think about the person, and it's more about them telling their story. Mm. But of course, with interviews, you would interject and you would make points. Whereas if it's Ronnie's story, I'm not there to judge Ronnie. Mm. It's Ronnie telling his version of the story, which, again, is quite an interesting issue.
So he would have 100% copyright approval, would he? That's something that is unusual
for a journalist. Yeah, that's a deal, because it's his story and he's getting paid the bulk of the money, and it's literally his copyright.
Yes.
You know, I would not share the copyright. But having said that, if I was doing a book with someone who wanted to do a, you know, kind of snow job on their career, I would feel uneasy about it. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about Ronnie and Dwayne was that they both were addicted to the truth. They were both desperate to tell the truth.
We'll come on to Dwayne in a little bit. Have you ever been tempted, Peter, to ghost anything? Have you? Presumably you would have had offers.
I've never had any offers to ghostwrite, mainly because I don't have anything like Simon's skill in interviewing people and talking to people. I have, in fact, ghosted a terrible article for a sports star when I was on the Evening Standard as part of that newspaper's ongoing, slightly rackety kind of attitude, at least it was in those days. In the 90s, I worked for the Evening Standard. I was asked to ghost an article by John Lloyd, the tennis player John Lloyd. And I made no attempt whatsoever to talk to him or to get his tone of voice or whatsoever. I just wrote the article himself, tried to imagine, sort of almost novelistically, tried to imagine what he thought and wrote this article. And John Lloyd told me it was the most He thought I was a very sweet chap, but it was the most embarrassing thing he'd ever read in his life or not written in his life, and I agreed with him.
I think it would be very difficult doing someone like John Lloyd. I mean, the thing about Ronnie is that he had a distinctive voice. Mm. Lots of people, especially kind of sports stars, don't have that distinctive voice, so I think you need a kind of neutral tone.
Exactly. Sports stars are the kind of silent movie stars of the world.
So,
but yes, there is something else. You
wrote Alan Clark, didn't you?
Yes.
He wasn't...
Yes.
I didn't know about it at the time.
Yes, there is something I should should add, is that I was also sued in the High Court for, well, not ghostwriting, I maintain, but satirising the voice of the late Tory MP Alan Clark, which I did week after week in the Evening Standard, which I flatter myself was good enough to fool the public, although we didn't try to fool the public. In fact, I was annoyed at having fooled the public because I wanted to get the praise myself. If I made a good joke in that column, I wanted to get the praise for it. I was annoyed that Alan Clark was getting praise for making good jokes. But yes, I did a sort of highly disreputable form of ghosting, satirising Alan Clark.
It's interesting that satire and ghosting, there's obviously some sort of, they're tied up together, aren't they, in the public mind?
Yes, I think they are the kind of twins, though. Ghostwriting is the sort of ostensibly the good twin, where you're not trying to take the mickey out of somebody. You are getting on board with them, and you are doing something which the author and journalist Janet Malcolm called translating into prose. That is to say, you listen to what they've got to say, you cut out the ums and ahs and the chaos that infects our everyday speech and translate it into prose, because we don't speak in prose any more than we speak in alexandrines or iambic pentameters. Prose is a construct, and the journalist's job is to create this and put it in the mouth of the celebrity.
Well, we thought it might be fun to call on our own bad twin, John Crace, to give an account of a recent top-level celebrity signing. Hunter Davis was paid an estimated £1 million to ghost three books for Wayne Rooney. Here's why volumes 2 and 3 have yet to appear.
Stamford Bridge, April the 29th, 2006. I felt something go pop. I didn't know it was a metatarsal at the time, but I knew it was serious. I wondered if I would miss the World Cup. Great start, Wazza. Now, if we could go back to your childhood. No worries, Hunter. I was nearly called Adrian, but I was called Wayne instead. And my mum has kept some reports from St. Swithin's Comprehensive, which said I would do better if I stopped gambling. But that was wrong, because I never gambled apart from the odd pounds here and there. We're starting to struggle, Waz. Can you give me some more details? Yeah. I did find a tenner on the pavement once, which I shared with my cousin Stephen. And I like to sleep with a hairdryer on. It drives Colleen mad. Fantastic. Now, tell me a bit about Colleen. I always thought she was well fit, like, but I didn't realise she fancied me till I mended her bike. Getting transferred to Man United was definitely a good move, as it is such a big club. I'm not going to make the word count if you don't give me more info. I'm writing it all down, but it's just not enough. My house is a sort of grey colour, but I'm not really any good at describing colours. Okay, that will do.
John Crace reflecting on the trials of Hunter Davis in extracting those pearls of wisdom we always knew Wayne Rooney must have somewhere. Now, changing tack slightly, Simon, there's another aspect to this, isn't there? We're told that history is written by the victors, but surely ghostwriting has given some victims a chance to have their say too.
I think that's an incredibly important thing about ghosting, and also about how it's changed in recent years. And, you know, again, that's part of it's got a slightly bad name now for misery memoirs, etc., etc. But my partner ghost wrote a book for a woman called Rosie Childs, who had had a terrible life of mental illness and being in institutions, and no one had ever listened to her. And she was actually working at Crisis at Christmas, and she was saying, does anyone want help with any writing? I'll help you. And she was expecting people to come along and say, yeah, can you do a letter for someone? And no one came along. And then Rosie came along at the end of the day and said, yeah, I want to write a book. Can you write a book for me? So Diane said, well, you know, maybe we could do chapter headings. And eventually they did write a book. And Diane always said to her, look, I'm doing this for you because it's not likely to get a publisher. But at least you've got your story. You've got your voice. And it did get published and became a bestseller. And again, with Dwayne, he was desperate to tell his story, but he didn't know how to or who to. And I'd interviewed him a couple of years before and ended up doing a very big piece when I followed him when he was charged. He was basically scapegoated by the police and he was charged with attempted rape and then cleared. And we'd had a very, very difficult beginning. He didn't trust me. The first time I met him, he accused me of everything. He accused me of being terrified of him, of smoking on the job, of doing proper journalists out of jobs because I didn't have shorthand. But in the end, he thought I was honest. And we ended up having a very close friendship. And I think part of what made that ghosting work was that there was a huge trust between us.
Do you think that that book actually made a difference?
It made a huge difference to him. It made a massive difference to him because he said, I think it empowered him. And he said he always felt it was as if there was something constricting him, you know, in his throat. There was something he had to get out and he didn't know where to start when people asked him about it. And he felt angry about everything that had happened. And it was a huge cathartic thing. It was a release. And he felt that if people asked him, he could just say, the book's there. And in a way, he didn't feel he had to talk about it.
Did it make a difference to the Stephen Lawrence story?
It did, because it was very controversial. Again, that got sued. We got sued over that. It's a very long story, but Dwayne has republished again by himself under Dwayne Brooks Books.
You did get sued, and you were successfully sued. Who was the complainant?
Doreen Lawrence.
The mother of Stephen Lawrence.
It was the mother of Stephen, yeah.
So you sort of waded right into almost a domestic there, didn't you?
It was a very, very fraught and controversial area where, you know, she had her version of the truth and Dwayne had his version of the truth.
What is your responsibility as the ghostwriter?
I think my responsibility as the ghostwriter in that situation is to make sure Dwayne's version of the truth is what I consider to be the truth. Now, obviously, you cannot check every detail of his life.
Were you liable as the ghostwriter to pay if there was a court order that money should be paid, or are you not because you're actually just hired to do your hired hand?
I think I could have been sued because my name was on it, but I didn't have copyright on it. I wouldn't have been the logical first person to go to, but I think I could have ended up having some liability over it. And that's why Dwayne ended up republishing just with his name on the book to protect me, in effect. But regards responsibility, I think it's questioning and re-questioning and checking what you can check to see that his version lines up with what other versions are there, or his story is consistent throughout. And it was fantastically consistent, and one of the reasons he's been able to bring the book out again is that what happened was that Doreen said she was in general portrayed as an uncaring mother. Dwayne disagreed with that and said we actually made a point of saying if anything she loved Stephen too much. It was a kind of tough love.
Well, let's leave that there. We could devote this whole podcast to it. I want to come on to the last and another very contested area, which is where this idea of celebrity branding using ghostwriting, Peter. You know, most obviously we've got the creation of Katie Price and her control of her image. Yeah. But it's not even just about memoir. It also goes into fiction. Surely that is an absolute nonsense that somebody could ghostwrite a novel for someone else.
Is it? I don't know. You see, you know, what are the laws of the marketplace, the financial marketplace, the cultural marketplace? If people enjoy these books, if they buy them, well, my goodness, you know, maybe the rules are changing. It certainly seems absurd to me. It certainly seems absurd that the person who really did write these books has got to literally efface their own existence and do these jobs for one-off fees and never get copyright, never get any renewing kind of, on the most basic level, income from these books, but never amass any critical reputation as authors.
And, of course, this has a long history, doesn't it? There's recently been a film in France about Dumas having...
As I understand it, used the work of a kind of hired hand, a lowly chap called Auguste Maquet, played by the Belgian actor Benoît Pellevoorde in the movie, which has not yet come out in this country.
It's called The Other Dumas.
L'Autre Dumas. A sophisticated literary critic listening to this conversation would tell us that, in fact, all texts are ghostwritten by any number of determinant forces. James Shapiro has returned, interestingly, to the subject of whether or not William Shakespeare, this massive kind of cultural icon and a guarantor of cultural value, has been effectively ghostwritten by, as it were, the Earl of Oxford or whatever. It's an endlessly fascinating subject. Jacques Derrida, asked by somebody once whether he believed in ghosts, said, yes, I believe in ghosts. Texts are ghosts. They are the product, they're a palimpsest of any number of ectoplasmic forms. I can imagine a time when books, celebrity books, have credits, have a credit list like movies. They will acknowledge that they are collaborative efforts. Even the highest of highbrow books may have, as it were, the top line would be the name of the auteur, as it were, John Updike. But then there will be, you know, the editor.
James Patterson, who's the top of the bestseller paperbacks list last year, he has about something like 13 books in the top 100 sellers, and each one credits a different co-writer.
Wow. Yeah.
And he is the brand, and they're
I can imagine... But
they're not ghosts then, are they?
No,
because they're credited.
They're credited. I can imagine a future in which there will be more and more of a kind of quasi-movie credit roll at the end of books, that people will start coming out of the closet, because some of the greatest books that we read have entirely unacknowledged contributions by editors. Some of the, you know, some of the greatest works of 20th century fiction have these people behind the scenes who presume to suggest to, as it were, Philip Roth that maybe that chapter would be better in that order, and you know, nobody has any stake, nobody has any vested interest in admitting that this goes on, but it does.
Mm. Going back to this, the idea of it being a dangerous thing, which comes very clearly out of the Robert Harris film.
Yeah.
There was in 2005 apparently the pharmaceutical pressure group in the States tried to commission a thriller to agitate against the importation of cheap drugs from Canada.
Yes.
And then they fell out with the ghostwriters, and the ghostwriter ended up writing it against the pharmaceutical industry.
What is funny about that is that traditionally thrillers from, you know, Robert Harris or maybe back to Frederick Forsyth, they always sympathise or appear to sympathise with a little guy. And it's the shadowy forces of big government and corporations. They are always the bad guys. And what's funny about this is that this corporation has attempted, audaciously, some might say, or possibly absurdly, to turn this on its head and to make the big nasty corporations the goodies. It's very funny, because it shows a kind of lack of appreciation of the generic quality of the conspiracy thriller.
Yeah, the book that actually eventually came out is called The Karasik Conspiracy. It's by Kenim M. Spivak and Julie Christin. One wonders what sort of a natural name that is.
Yes.
So we're now where we're seeing the future is that it's a load of ghosts.
It may be a load of ghosts. It may be that the ghosts or the hidden hands, the hired hands of that are in the fiction business may be much more acknowledged than they are now. But this will be at the expense of diluting the pungency and force of why we read, especially why we read fiction. We like the idea of losing ourselves in a created world which is vividly and tactilely the work of some individual, that you have a kind of one-to-one relationship with the author, and you're going to lose that.
Yeah,
with
but now we can lose ourselves in a brand, can't we?
Yeah, well, this
we
is
can lose ourselves in the Jordan brand.
And Jordan, quite openly, when she was asked about her book, she said, I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, I interviewed Jordan, and she said that she felt she was the author of her novels because she was very much involved. So I said, what is that involvement? So she said, well, you know, I kind of think of what I'd like, a story, you know, involving maybe, you know, a horse and a relationship and a boyfriend. And then I tell the writer, and she goes out and writes it and sends it back to me.
OK, so there you have it. We've gone from Shakespeare to Robert Harris, and we've ended up with Jordan. Thanks very much for coming in. And that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Peter Bradshaw, Simon Hattonstone and John Crace. Coming up in this weekend's Saturday Review, David Hare explains why theatre should never be confused with journalism. And Booker winner Anne Enright reviews the mongrel fiction of her Irish compatriot Hugo Hamilton. The Observer Sunday Review has an interview with Philippa Perry, author of a new graphic novel about psychotherapy, Couch Fiction. Next week we'll be reporting from the London Book Fair, but that's all for now. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Corley.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.